This is Sharp Money with Patrick Maher and Amal Shaw on VSIN, the Sports Betting Network.
One more hour of Sharp Money here from Las Vegas in our South Point Sportsbook studios. Welcome back in. I'm Ben Wilson. Amal Shaw with me on the desk. Dustin Sweetelson behind the glass. A lot for us still to get to. I'm excited for Amal in or Amal out because we got some great topics, Amal. Pumped for that in about 15 minutes. So giddy up. We got some Wimbledon plays and just some general thoughts because we're down to the final four, men's and women's semis. We'll discuss that here a little bit later. We'll talk with Antoine Staley, New York Daily News, to break down the Jets now that they have been confirmed on Hard Knocks. Also some other thoughts on the New York Jets. And for right now, to start the hour, we'll talk some Major League Baseball on the heels of the All-Star Game and getting ready for the second half of the season. Welcome in John Bowman from CBS Sports MLB analyst. Also spent time in player development with the Toronto Blue Jays. And what I like about John Amal is that he's a big college baseball guy as well. So, I mean, you're locked in everywhere. Congrats on a great MLB draft. Saw the plays, 8-2 on the draft. So that's one of those things now that we're getting more and more availability to actually bet on. And it's like the last draft that's actually come out of the Stone Ages into the, all right, let's make this a legitimate event here. So what were your takeaways, A, from the draft with, you know, with Paul Skeens going first overall to Pittsburgh, and B, how can we apply that as bettors now going forward?
Yeah, so as a bettor, I rarely bet more than one unit on any play in general. I hate the whole idea of, you know, boosting your record or making multi-unit plays to kind of get that record up. But I didn't understand the Paul Skeens line whatsoever. I mean, you have a generational talent like that, and you're going to take him. Ben Charrington, the GM of the Pirates, is actually my old boss. So I feel like I do know him in a sense, and I feel like I kind of knew the route that he was going to go. His scouting director is also Steve Sanders, who I worked with as well. So it's very interesting to see how the lines move. And it's very cool to see, you know, lots of props being offered on the draft in the future. I feel like it's a great way to get people involved in baseball because it's the only draft where these guys kind of get drafted and then, you know, go off into nowhere and you don't hear from them for another couple of years.
Sure. It was just a fascinating Amal. Paul Skeens, you know, National Pitcher of the Year in college baseball, and he slipped on draft day. He was all the way down in the plus 250, plus 270 range, and ends up just being a giant smokescreen, and he goes one overall.
Yeah, I think you guys are both correct. I think this is such an opportunity to take advantage because people don't follow college baseball as closely. John, you played at Tulane, so obviously you have tremendous insight. Ben, you call a lot of college sports, so it's an opportunity to take advantage. I want to switch to the pros right now. I want to go with the American League East first, Ben. When you look at it, right now, Tampa's got a 4-game lead over Baltimore in the win column, tied in the loss column. But I think the Yankees are dangerous based on the second half schedule, pretty weak. But the team to me that you know well, I think they're dangerous is the Toronto Blue Jays. I like their pitching. The hitting is starting to come around. They're only 6 games behind. Not a bad shot to me at 7.5-1 to win the division.
Yeah, I'm actually on them from before the season to win the division. So I kind of have to just ride it out at this point. I can't really double down there. But the weird thing is in the AL, if you look at it, you've got a few teams that are vying for the playoff spots, right? The Blue Jays are technically in right now. The Yankees are technically out. Both teams have plus money odds to miss the playoffs. So there's some odds weirdness going on there. Whereas one of these teams is going to be the odd man out. They're going to be a very good baseball team and they're going to miss the playoffs. I don't think it's going to be the Orioles. I definitely don't think it's going to be the Astros. So we might end up having either the Blue Jays or the Yankees fight for that last spot. Then you have the Mariners coming on as well too. So it'll be really interesting going down the stretch.
And think about what the Yankees are doing at the deadline, a team that's bottom 5 in average and OPS in the majors. They hire Sean Casey now as the hitting coach. From your perspective, having worked on player development, what legitimate impact is that going to have, do you view, in season there for the Yankees?
It'll be really interesting. I think the biggest thing here is it just brings a new perspective, a new set of eyes, and you can kind of look at everybody's swing from the outside looking in. You know, obviously, I'm sure that they love their hitting coach, and, you know, he's been with them, but sometimes it just helps to get new eyes on something. Like, all these guys are very, very smart and very good at their jobs, but sometimes just, you know, switching things around helps.
John, two-part question here. Shohei Ohtani, first, do you believe he gets traded? And second, if you were in charge of the Angels, what would you do with him?
Yeah, I do not think he gets traded. I think they're a little, you know, deep there. They just don't want to get rid of him at this point. And, you know, they don't want to be looked at as those guys who – they don't want to be looked at him as those guys who let him go during free agency, but they also don't want to be looked at as the guys that traded him away and let him go. If I were the Angels, I would go full rebuild right now. I would get rid of Ohtani. I would trade Trout. I would keep some of his contract money to try to get prospects elsewhere. I would go full rebuild if I were them. This team is not close to competing. They haven't been close to competing in the past couple of years. And you have two of the best players in the world. So If I were them, I would go full rebuild.
Would make a lot of sense based on where we're at right now.
So it won't happen for sure.
Based on past history. Yes, that's what you're saying. Well, John Bowman, you can follow him at JohnBowman11, joining us right now here on VSiN Sharp Money. And I love the Tulane jersey as well. You got great, most underrated Cinderella run of any collegiate program in any sport this year. Amal, Tulane baseball won, I think, 14 games in the regular season out of, 50, 60 game regular season. They won the American Conference Tournament as the last team in. And they found themselves in the NCAA tournament with like a 19-40 record. It was crazy.
Yeah, but the problem for John and all the former Tulane baseball players is they won the Cotton Bowl against USC. So that kind of took the cake over everything in Tulane sports this year.
I mean, I know. I'm just saying, John.
Yeah, it's exactly. It is the year of the wave.
It is the year of the wave. John, when you win like 25% of your games and then you end up in an NCAA tournament, that is pretty remarkable from a pure numbers basis, as much as Amal is correct on the Tulane football front.
That's when you just know it's your year, when literally everything is going your way. I mean, Tulane football won, what, two games last year, too? So everything is just falling for the green wave at this point.
No doubt on that. So we're talking to some of these second half teams, and especially in the American League. So a team that I really like, and I look at them at +360 to make the postseason in the Seattle Mariners. And I'm just curious your thoughts on the hitting perspective for the M's, because they're bottom six in average, but like they're top eight in the league in barrel percentage, hard hit rate. How much of a return and regression to the mean in a positive way do you view this Mariners team becoming in the second half?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked that. I love the Mariners. I was on the Mariners to win the World Series before the season, and obviously they got off to a super slow start, but I'm not wavering with that play. I think they finally figured out a groove going down the stretch. The only thing is, like I just mentioned, there aren't many spots in the American League to make the playoffs right now, right? We're already assuming either the Blue Jays or the Yankees are going to miss in that seventh spot. Well, you have the Mariners as well there. So it would be tough to get in, but I do think this team is more than capable, especially with the injuries that the Yankees are dealing with. And, maybe a couple other teams sliding, maybe the Rangers slide a little bit. So it'll be interesting.
John, you bring up a good point. Last year, remember they struggled and then they turned it on in July. They opened the post All-Star break season with a bunch of home games, 3 against Detroit, 4 against the Twinkies, and then 3 against the Blue Jays in Seattle. But those are like Blue Jays home games. I'm telling you right now, everybody from Vancouver and BC comes down. It's unbelievable how many Blue Jays fans you hear during that time. So we'll see. But tell me a little bit more about what you like about Seattle, because I'm with you. I think you can get them at some nice long odds. I don't think there's any Atlanta Braves in the American League. And I think if they get in the postseason, this team is very dangerous.
Yeah, I think it's just all about pitching for the Mariners. And the thing is, they have so much pitching depth, so much starting pitching depth, so much bullpen pitching depth, that if their bats can get hot, even slightly hot, score a few runs, then they're going to be dangerous. I mean, we saw in the postseason last year them having their first playoff series in 20-something years and coming out and beating the Blue Jays, who had been in a playoff series within a couple of years before that. So they had a little bit more experience than them. So the Mariners are very dangerous and they can make a run as if they can find those bats. And recently they've been finding those bats. So I think they're more than capable of making the playoffs.
The Mariners finished the year last year from July on 22 games over .500, and they're 7-2 in the month of July on so far this year. The only time I've been to T-Mobile Park was a start Felix Hernandez was making. It was, I want to say, 2014, and was facing the Toronto Blue Jays, and I didn't even think about like what you just said, just that, it's Team Canada.
Yeah.
And it was unbelievable atmosphere, sold out, probably 70% Blue Jay fans. And then all the little, the King Felix, they had their little towels. It's like one of the coolest baseball games I've ever been to.
It's huge for people that are unfamiliar. It is a huge following there for the Blue Jays. They are definitely the national team. Want to, John, kind of put you on the spot a little bit here. Blake Snell right now is 15-1 to win the NL Cy Young. Dustin and I have talked at length about this. We took him at 40-1 and 35-1 respectively. I don't see anybody being clear cut. Strider's been tremendous. Zach Gallen's been great. Kershaw at 4-1, but he's on the shelf. I don't understand why there's lack of affinity for Blake Snell, who's been the best pitcher in baseball over the last 9-10 starts.
Yeah, I agree with you there. I think those are definitely a bit long. I mean, you've got your Zach Gallens and your Spencer Striders. Your Spencer Strider might be a little more, I guess, sexy would be the word for it, maybe, in a sense of he gets a ton more strikeouts, but and way fewer walks. And, he's a little more consistent, but Blake Snell is the more dominant, and he's had the more dominant starts where he'll have, a ton of strikeouts. So I think those odds are definitely long. I agree.
John, before we let you go, looking at a division that is really hard to pinpoint, like an NL Central, Brewers remain the minus money favorite at minus 110. Reds are now almost even with them at plus 130. Seems like a two-team race. Do you view it that way, or is there another long shot you'd look at there?
As much as I want to think that the Cardinals are still going to make a run and somewhat make it back into this race, I don't think it's going to happen this late in the season. I do think the Cubs could be around there. The thing is, they're just so inconsistent that it's hard to bet on them. The Pirates, I think, are, you know, closer to being done in the division as well. So yeah, I do think it is mostly a Reds and Brewers race to the finish. I don't know how many wins each of them are going to end up with, though, because I don't think the Brewers are that great of a team, and the Reds are very thin in starting pitching with Nick Lodolo and Hunter Green on the IL right now. Both of them should be back somewhat soon after the break, but it'll be tough.
John, we got about 30 seconds on Friday when we restart. Will it favor the pitchers with a bunch of number ones going, or will the offenses be able to get on track with a 5-day layoff?
That's a good question. I think you could see it all around. I don't think there would be one consistent one way. I think it'll be all about routines per player.
Give him a follow at John Bowman 11, CBS Sports Major League Baseball analyst. John, we cannot thank you enough for giving us the time. Thank you so much for the insights.
Awesome. Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
You talk about that NL Central, all Brewers Reds right out of the chute, that massive series to open the second half.
Well, the Brewers took 2 out of 3. And yeah. I thought this series, this 6-game stretch was really going to be a potential to determine the division. Milwaukee's in good shape because you're going to have the guys that pitched last weekend go again. Great chance for them to really put some separation between them and Cincinnati.
Brewers should have swept, but then they just basically stopped paying attention and let LA De La Cruz steal home. And that was how they lost the one game in that series. So a lot still for us to get to, including I'm all in. Or I'm all out. Have some great topics for you coming up next on Sharp Money.
This is Sharp Money with Patrick Maher and Amal Shaw on VSIN, the sports betting network.
Become a VSIN Pro subscriber today and get a daily email recapping all the best bets from our show hosts and guests. You'll also get unlimited access to our VSIN.com/picks page. Sort picks by sport, matchup, event date, and more. Check the top VSIN experts leaderboard to view betting records, profit, and ROI, and see which VSIN expert has the hot hand for VSIN Pro picks, betting splits, power ratings, plus 24/7 video access. Become a VSIN Pro subscriber today. Sign up now for only $19 at VSIN.com/subscribe. As we welcome you back, Sharp Money from Las Vegas. We sort of neglected our Dead or Alive segment a little bit earlier today, Amal, so we're going to mix them. We got Dead or Alive. We've got them all in or them all out. Dustin, we've had a lot of guests today, so I haven't been able to banter as much as I like to normally with Dustin. So,
I'm enjoying it because it's I am a T-minus 46 minutes and 44 minutes until vacation.
Oh.
So I've just been sitting back and enjoying the program.
The program.
All right, first one here. We'll combine it. We'll make it all. I'm all in. I'm all out. The market has yet to adjust in the NL West, and rightfully so, as the Dodgers remain the favorite at minus 230. The Arizona Diamondbacks 4-1 to win that division. I'm all in. I'm all out. The Arizona Diamondbacks can still win the West.
All out. They're in trouble. The Dodgers are coming. I thought the Dodgers were a good bet a couple of weeks ago when they had an opportunity when they got swept by the San Francisco Giants. This team is just over 162. The talent is overwhelming. Think about this. The second and third betting favorites for the MVP in the National League are on the Dodgers.
Kind of an issue.
Yeah.
Well, and you think about the youth for Arizona, and even though I completely believe in Corbin Carroll,
yeah,
first rookie ever, 15 homers, 25 stolen bases at the break to keep maintaining what he is doing individually. But I mean, especially now with Merrill Kelly going on the IL, that's a huge concern. Where he's been a reliable source for them, and everybody wants to point to Zach Gallen, you know, leading the way in that pitching rotation. But they're bottom eight now in starting ERA, and I don't see, like, Zach Davies is not a guy you want to rely on for consistent starts. So I don't, you know, unless Brandon Foch just comes out and has an amazing second half, which he's a rookie, you can't really count on that. I would tend to agree.
They already needed a pitcher before Merrill Kelly got hurt. Then Kelly goes down.
Yeah.
Now they need two arms. Although it sounds like Kelly might be back sooner than we think with the blood clots.
See, I still think the Dodgers, even though they're right now a game ahead in the loss column, one game behind in the win column of the Arizona Diamondbacks, I still think the Dodgers, even at minus 230, are a good bet to win the division.
They're just so top heavy. Like, you have Freeman hitting 320. They don't have anyone else hitting 300. And then they have 1, 2, 3 guys hitting over 20 homers this year, One at 17, one at 11, one at 13. Like, they're a very top-heavy lineup. Like, they don't have the depth that we're used to seeing from the Dodgers, who can hit you with the two different split lineups.
You're not wrong, but they're going to get Walker Buehler back in September. Julio Urias has been a little bit inconsistent and out.
He stinks.
He's going to get the start on Friday. I'll tell you the big problem for them has been Tony Gonsolin. Gonsolin's been pretty bad the last month.
Yeah, and he was really good to start out, but he just doesn't have overpowering stuff. He's not a true ace.
In fairness, though, I mean, Gonsolin.
An ace.
His ERA is very, very good.
You talking about Tony the Tiger?
He has a very good career ERA.
So I'm glad you brought that up, Dustin, because Gonsolin, this guy had some sort of magic spell. I don't know what he was doing because he outpitched his peripherals by like three runs each of the last 3-4 years. It's amazing. Guy perennially had a sub-2 ERA with like a 4.5 xFIP, and it's finally come crashing down to earth. And I'm glad it finally happened because you can't skirt reality forever.
He's got a 2.78 career ERA over the course of 1, 2, 3, 5 seasons.
I'm not saying his numbers aren't good, but this is a guy he can never go deep into games. An ace,
and he doesn't strike guys out.
Well, he's a 4 1/3 innings kind of pitcher. He's like, who's the kid? Alex Wood. Alex Wood was always Mr. 4 1/3 innings.
You're living in a different decade when you talk. Like, there are 5 innings is what we expect out of a starter these days.
No, that's what you expect. But here's the thing.
No, that's what these teams expect.
Look, the bottom line is if you're good enough to get through the lineups without flipping them over as much, you can get those innings then.
And there's very few guys who are still capable of being that.
Yeah, Tony. I'm not a Tony Gonsolin guy.
Nobody is.
Diamondback, just on this NOS point, Diamondbacks open second half of the year at Toronto.
Oh, tough.
The tough three. That's a tough way to begin your second half. And as long as they're rolling out a Zach Davies, Tommy Henry, like every fifth day, it's hard for me to have a lot of faith.
They need two arms even with Merrill Kelly coming back. And you can't trust Gallen on the road. That matters as well. All right, next ticket here. Let's move. You know, everyone else has talked. I feel like we've had a couple guests on the network today mention this team. John Bowman just did as well. 22-1, the Seattle Mariners to win the AL pennant. Are you all in or all out that the Mariners have another second half run in them?
All in. They're 4 games back of the wild card, I think. But the division is still attainable. That's the one thing I think where the difference is, guys, when you look at them. They're not out of reach for this division. I don't love the Astros. They're 6 games behind the Texas Rangers right now, 5 in the loss column, more importantly. I think this team is dangerous. I'm not a believer in the Yankees, even though the schedule is pretty easy. I think Seattle's got an opportunity. What surprised me a little bit, though, the Red Sox are ahead of them in the standings.
Yeah, by a couple of games right now as we start the second half. I agree. Mariners also have the 5th easiest strength of schedule rest of the way. And so you're set up in a team that has done this before.
Yep.
It's wild that they were 4 games under 500 through June last year, 4 games under 500 through June this year. They went into the All-Star break winning 9 of 10 last year. They go into the All-Star break winning 7 of 9 this year. And it does kind of feel like the Caesar parting and everything is just not, you know, obviously it's dangerous to do that as a better guys, but that's what I can't help but think about their second half stretch here.
And you know, because of the payroll, we talk about the Padres and the Mets being these massive disappointments. The Mariners are a massive disappointment this year because I think we all thought they were going to take the next step. But of those 3 that have been so disappointing, this team has all the pieces to still put it together and make a run. I love their lineup. I love their rotation. They somehow find guys for the bullpen every year. Like they do know what they're doing up there. And I think this team is a fascinating watch in the second half.
Yeah. Would you trust any other organization to develop like college pitching as well? Because 3 guys they have in their rotation, if you go past Luis Castillo, all college arms who they've brought up homegrown through the system and are legit major league starters now.
I love George Kirby. I don't know about you. He's like great. Like they're very efficient games when he pitches.
I traded away Logan Gilbert in fantasy for Tyler O'Neill, like first week of the season. What dumbest thing I've done. Now, did I know Tyler O'Neill was going to get hurt and be out the whole year? No. But.
Yeah. Didn't hustle 1 game, then got benched. Yeah.
Basically.
Yeah. Kirby and Castillo have been very good. Sorry, go ahead.
Next one here. I'm all in, I'm all out. Victor Wembanyama can only disappoint us based on the expectations.
No, because we saw Tiger Woods and LeBron James exceed expectations. I just think people are, you know, a lot of the people who are saying, oh, he's not going to be that good. I'm going to tell you right now, they've never played competitive basketball. Because when you see 7-5 and you got to shoot over that, you really can't quantify what that is. I don't think people truly understand that.
I think we're also in an era, too, where we want to overreact and make a bulletin board statement about singular games. And this is a guy who, like, having watched him in person, Amal, when he came out here with his French team for that that showcase against the G League team, you watch him in person and you're like, this guy, never seen anything like this. Yeah. And he obviously needs to grow into his body and develop some muscle, because what we saw at the Summer League in that 2-for-13 field goal outing, guys, like, the strategy was from the Charlotte coaches, all right, let's just throw all these big bruisers, let's just beat him up as much as we can. That is the one thing he'll have to improve on, but the skills are there. And I think to suggest that it's only a disappointment is a little bit of a reach. So I would agree with him all there.
I'm taking notes that both you guys like George Muresan with flexibility, Yao Ming without lunch, Manute Bol with handles, Sean Bradley with a little bit of wiggle, and Frederick Weiss with a jumper. That's exactly
what
Victor
Wembanyama. You don't have a Primoz Brezic comp?
I don't even know who that is.
Hold on. Frederick Weiss was the guy who played for France and drafted by the Knicks, correct?
Yes.
The other guys you mentioned, Manute Bol was too skinny, didn't have the athleticism, neither did Sean Bradley.
Why are you taking what I said seriously?
Because I don't think you appreciate how good this kid's going to be.
I think I'm a little sick and tired of everyone saying how he's going to change. I think he's going to be fine.
Hold on a second. George Raveling made this comment about Kevin Durant when he came out. He goes, he's going to be the leading scorer in the history of the NBA. He may not get there, but Kevin Durant is an all-time top 10 scorer in the history of the game from what he could do offensively. There are just certain players that are going to be great, and I think Victor's one of them.
I just think we've never seen anyone at his height, with his body, with this playing style, to assume it's all just going to work out perfectly and he's going to be a Mount Rushmore player is a little bit hard for me to fathom.
I don't disagree, because it's a long way to go, but the reality is, just forget his offensive ability. First of all, nobody's going to be able to obstruct his shot. You know, you look at Yao. Yao was a very good 15-foot face-up jumper. And then Yao obviously was physically much bigger in terms of weight, but defensively, the problems he's going to cause, you see some of these offensive rebounds. I mean, this is like taking a Nerf ball from a kid for him.
Sure.
You can't stop him. And then he's got a great jump shot. He's also better than 80% at the free throw line.
Also, this isn't like he's coming in, being drafted in the mid-90s, where he's got to go up against Patrick Ewing and Alonzo Mourning in the paint every night. Like, the way the NBA has changed, it completely benefits. I don't care if you've never seen a 7'5 guy before. It totally benefits his style of play in today's day and age.
I think Ben makes an excellent point. You don't have those 270-pound centers like Ewing, Olajuwon, David Robinson, all these guys every night you're going to play against guys that are bangers inside. This is a much easier situation. He can sit out on the perimeter offensively.
His body could shut down in 5 years. We don't know. ankles.
A banger in today's NBA is like 6'7", 240.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, for being real. I'm all in, I'm all out. I enjoyed that. That was a lot of fun. We're going to talk some New York Jets. They are officially on Hard Knocks. We'll get the take from Antoine Staley from the New York Daily News. He's a Jets beat reporter, and we'll talk with Antoine right after this.
This is Sharp Money with Patrick Maher and Amal Shaw on VSIN, the sports betting network.
Download the DraftKings app today, and new customers can bet $5 and get $150 in bonuses instantly. Use promo code VSIN when you sign up. See DraftKings.com/sportsbook for full terms and conditions. Well, it's the latest we've ever had to wait, but we finally have the team that will be on Hard Knocks. I can sense the anticipation from across the desk with the Hard Knocks. Going to be the New York Jets in 2023. We have Antoine Staley set to join us right now. Talk a little Jets. Talk some AFC East as a whole here as we break down that division and previewing the 2023 NFL season. Give him a follow at Antoine Staley. Covers the Jets for the New York Daily News. And it was sort of that unkept secret, I suppose, Antoine. We all sort of knew it was going to happen. And finally, it's made official. So just yet another, I guess a microscope on this Jets team that has been broken down so vociferously all off season. What's been the main thing that stood out to you from the time that quarterback Aaron Rodgers got to OTAs that has been something that you've really been focusing on as far as how this team is trying to gel if it is going to be a successful year in 2023 with Aaron Rodgers in the fold?
Well, I think he's really changed the culture of the team in the short time. I mean, he's holding players accountable. He's being in meetings, not necessarily quarterback meetings and wide receiver meetings, running back meetings, offensive line. He's helping out the players learn the new offense because Nathaniel Hackett is now the new offensive coordinator. So I think they just, they'll hear the word about accountability and just, trying to change, the culture, really, basically. This is a young team that finished 7-10 last year, had an opportunity to make the playoffs. They were 7-4 at one point in time and lost it straight to end the year. And, that's a, they left a bitter taste in their mouth, and now with Aaron Rodgers, they believe that they have an opportunity to compete for a Super Bowl. But, yeah, I think that's the biggest thing there, just changing the culture and the vibe around Fulham Park. You know, that's something that Aaron Rodgers has done in his short time there.
Antoine, how much does the defense improve with an offense that doesn't go three plays and a punt on fourth down every two series?
Well, I think last year their defense, despite not getting a lot of turnovers, I mean, they finished fourth in the league in points allowed and also yards. So I think anytime you can add a guy like Aaron Rodgers who can, you know, keep the offense on the field and keep you rested, I think that's going to be a big deal. I think you saw the defense for the Jets kind of wear down late in the season last year. They definitely wasn't really the same unit there. They let up some big plays there where you talk about, you know, against Detroit Lions there or against the Seattle Seahawks late in the season that were backbreakers. So to have a guy like that that can keep your offense on the field. And also I think a running game too, if Breece Hall can get back to form, of course he tore his ACL last year against Denver, he can return somewhere close to the form that he was. I think that'll be, you know, very beneficial to the defense.
And that's why everybody, Antoine, they're focusing on the offensive side because of the addition of Aaron Rodgers. But when you look at the defense, even one that was, as you mentioned, just taxed so heavily with the lack of offensive play, finished fourth in fewest yards per drive allowed in the NFL. This was a top six pass defense, top 12 rush defense. From the personnel perspective, what adjustments, what changes do you expect we'll see on the field when we actually look at what the Jets defense presents in this upcoming season?
I mean, first and foremost, trying to get Quinn Williams happy. Obviously, right now he's in a bit of a he's unhappy because of his lack of, you know, contract extension. You know, the Jets and Quinn Williams have been talking for a while about a contract extension. Nothing has been it's come to fruition. I don't know if it's going to happen this year, but he is in their plans, and they do want to keep him for the foreseeable future. There, they just have to have some things to show up there first and foremost about Aaron Rodgers' particular contract situation. But, yeah, you get him back, and, you know, you still have C.J. Mosley there. I know they don't technically have Quan Alexander there, who I think was a big part of the defense last year, but they can re-sign him at any time there. Obviously, the quarterback room is legit where you have a guy like Sauce Gardner, who was a first-team All-Pro, the first one at the quarterback position as a rookie since Ronnie Lott. And then you also have DJ Reed, who I think is very underrated still in this league. And Michael Carter II, too. I thought he did a tremendous job there, too. So they believe, along with the cornerbacks, they say Jordan Whitehead will have a much better year than what he did last year. I think they believe the defense, it may not be statistically finished fourth like I did last year because that's so hard to do, but they still believe that, you know, they are one of the, they're going to be one of the elite defenses in the league this upcoming year.
Antoine, where do you see the Jets finishing in this division?
Right now, for me, I think I'm going to pick them second. Like, I think a lot of people pick the Bills, but, I'm just not so sold on the Bills. I don't think they've really done a whole lot. I do think they're a playoff team, but, you know, you heard the rumors about Stephon Diggs and him not being happy with, you know, certain instances with the coaching staff or Josh Allen in particular. And it's just a lot of, you know, noise coming out of there. So I think this is an opportunity for the Jets and also the Dolphins. I think the Dolphins have an opportunity, provided if Tua can stay healthy. That's obviously the big if. But if he stays healthy, we saw what Miami was able to do last year, especially with all the weapons that they had. And I think they'll be much improved, especially with Vic Fangio coordinating the defense. But I think in the end, you're going to have three playoff teams with the Jets, the Bills, and the Dolphins. And I wouldn't be surprised if the Patriots, you know, even though they might finish in fourth place, but I wouldn't be surprised if they had like eight wins. So that's why I think this defense, the division is going to be so tough and, you know, on top to bottom.
The win totals this year in that division, Buffalo 10.5, Jets, Dolphins each 9.5, and then New England with the Patriots 7.5, as Antoine Staley, New York Daily News Jets beat reporter, joins us right now. Give him a follow at Antoine Staley on Twitter. And you've covered this division for a long time, going back to when you're covering the Dolphins here. And it's just weird to be in this mold now, Antoine, where we're just sort of discounting the Patriots. We've really barely talked about that team overall here, with having still head coach and Bill Belichick at the helm with a 7.5 win total. If New England is going to break up the party, you said your prediction is three playoff teams here. Like, what realistically has to happen for the Patriots to actually be a threat, aside from just, well, it's Belichick and he's got all the rings, so you just sort of trust him? What else besides that will need to take place here for New England to have some sort of success?
Well, Matt Jones needs to play kind of like how he did as a rookie. I think having, you know, getting Bill O'Brien there to coordinate the offense. Last year you had Matt Patricia and, you know, a lot of guys had no business being there trying to coordinate an offense, especially with a young quarterback. Now you have Bill O'Brien, who, you know, whatever you want to say about his experience with the Texans, I mean, the man was a winner. Like, he, you know, successful job there in Houston, and now he comes to back to New England, and I think that'll be, you know, obviously he's been in the Belichick system before with the Patriots there, so he'll have no problem kind of coordinating and meshing with Belichick in that regard. But yeah, I think, you know, if he can get, you know, Matt Jones to be confident and lower the interceptions and look like a quality quarterback, and, you know, you got Ramondre Stevens. I think the Patriots have the best offensive line in the division by far, and then you know their defense is going to be sound. Matthew Judon is just a complete beast and one of the better edge rushers in the NFL. So I think they have a shot. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if they were to win 9 games, maybe, but at the same time, I wouldn't be surprised if they were to win 7 or 8. But yeah, I think they're going to have a lot to say about who's end up winning this division in the end, because ultimately, you might have to sweep the Patriots in order to do it. And as we know, no matter how they are, it's always going to be a tough task.
Antoine, when you look at the AFC big picture, give me your top three teams before we even start the regular season.
You put me on the spot here.
Sorry, I apologize.
Jamal does that from time to time.
It's all good. As of right now, obviously, all of this can change. But you know what? I know a lot of people are picking Kansas City, and, you know, rightfully so, with Patrick Mahomes and company. But I really like the Bengals. I really think this is going to be their time to shine. So for me, I would put Cincinnati there, especially with the addition of Orlando Brown Jr. I think that was huge to try to fortify the offensive line. So I would put the Bengals slightly over the Chiefs there. Obviously, it's Kansas City number two. And then third, I mean, I'll pick the Dolphins. I'll pick the Dolphins just because, like I said, I like what I saw last year. I thought they were hitting on all cylinders. Just about, you know, it's the big if Tua can stay healthy. So if he can, then, you know, I think the Dolphins can definitely contend in the AFC. If not, then, you know, you have to look at somebody like the Chargers or even Jacksonville. I think Jacksonville is going to continue to get better with Trevor Lawrence and Doug Peterson behind the scenes there.
Yeah, high praise for the Miami Dolphins coming in. But you look at what Vic Fangio will bring as a defensive coordinator. I'm just fascinated to see, Antoine. It's such a stark contrast to what they've had as this blitz-heavy team, even when you go back to the Brian Flores led Dolphins teams of years past. So how different is Miami going to look defensively based on scheming perspective and what Fangio is going to try to do there for a defense that has really struggled the last couple of years?
I think, schematically, I think it's a lot going to be probably about the same. Like, as far as what they run, it's going to run like, you know, a 3-4 system. It's just a matter of, you know, getting players in the right form. And, you know, Bradley Chubb, they spent a lot to go get Bradley Chubb there pretty much at the trade deadline last year. And we know Chubb is, you know, he was there in Denver when Fangio was there, you know, with the Broncos. So, and one thing Fangio could do is coordinate defenses there. So I think the biggest difference you're definitely going to see is the secondary, you know, getting Jalen Ramsey there, you know, go along with Xavien Howard, who looks like he's healthy now. Last year he played, you know, well less than 100%. But if you get those guys, you know, going right, they're one of the top, if not the top, best quarterback group in the NFL. And then you also have a budding star, I think, you know, and Javon Holland, too. So, yeah, I think the secondary is also going to be key. That's what Vic Fangio specializes in his defense is there, and I think that's what's going to stand out.
Give him a follow at Antoine Staley, outstanding beat reporter for the New York Jets for the New York Daily News. You're already going to be busy to begin with. You know, this will just go up another notch, Antoine. Best of luck with the upcoming Jets season. You know, it always is, but thank you for joining us.
Not really. It's going to be a circus either way, but, you know, it's just more media attention. But it's good to be on with you, and hopefully I can come on again.
Absolutely. We look forward to having you on in the future. We'll go over our top plays for the rest of the card, looking ahead to tomorrow when we wrap up the show next.
This is Sharp Money with Patrick Maher and Amal Shaw on VSiN, the sports betting network.
It's always football season here at VSiN, which is why we've already released our NFL betting guide. Our NFL betting guide will help you get ahead of the upcoming NFL season with in-depth profiles of every team, including advanced stats, proven betting systems, and proprietary betting trends, plus best bets on season win totals, futures, and props. Become a VSiN Pro subscriber today for as low as $19 and get your digital copy of the VSiN NFL betting guide. Or take advantage of our summer kickoff special and get access to everything we do through the Super Bowl for only $175. Sign up today at VSiN.com/subscribe. We're back for the final time. Dustin Sweetelson behind the glass, very excited to kick off his vacation tomorrow in 10 minutes on the dot. Airport beer, Dustin? That's
The airport beer will be happening. I was just looking. I have a debate, inner debate going on for like $150. I can upgrade my seat to a bigger seat, but also not sit next to anyone guaranteed, it looks like, I think, because all those seats are kind of empty, the upgraded seats. Do I do that?
What airline are you flying?
JetBlue.
Is that mint?
I don't think so.
Is it like a pod? Is it the, because there's the business class pod on JetBlue, which I would say for $150, yes. But if it's just, it just depends.
I think it's just an extra legroom seat is the thing. But like, I really cross country flight to Boston. I have no one next to me at the moment. But you, in a regular seat, those fill up quickly. Those middle seats, I can guarantee. Maybe a chance at no one sitting next
guarantee,
to me if I pay more.
Maybe a chance.
Because I don't know how they fill these seats in, but they're all extra money.
So I'm not the right person to ask in this. I don't spend money on a lot of things, but I can tell you right now, I upgrade all my seats because a long flight, 5 hours to Boston, yeah. I don't want to be uncomfortable.
And you got to remember my size here, what we're dealing with.
To me, it's a no-brainer. I look at it at $30 an hour.
$30, yeah, sure.
That's not bad. Because sitting on that plane, if I thought, you know, for $30 this hour, I could be more comfortable, I would pay that.
Yeah.
It's funny. I was on a Southwest flight a couple of weeks ago. There'll be always that one seat that's open, right?
Yeah.
I'm like, it's an hour flight. I don't fly Southwest unless it's an hour flight. I hate that airlines.
Unless they want to sponsor us. Then we love it.
Yeah, right. You kidding me? The amount they're charging, they should be able to afford a sponsorship right now. But I'm like, I just take the first seat. I'm like, dude, it's an hour flight. I'm not going back 15 rows to take 15 minutes to get off the plane. It doesn't even make sense to me. The reason why I hate Southwest is actually a great airlines. I hate their open seating.
There are a lot of bad rules in sports. That's the worst rule in airlines.
100% agree.
Show up free for all.
Why is it that I have a really hard time imagining Amal Shaw getting on a Southwest flight? That's not your aesthetic. I just don't see it.
That's fair. It's funny. So I'm planning a trip coming up in August, and it was like we were having a conversation about when we're getting on the plane. I said, let me tell you something. I said, I'm the last person on the plane. When I get on the plane, you don't have to worry about it. You take whatever seat you want. There's nobody getting on behind me. I'm like, where are you all going in a hurry? We're all
so
getting there at the same time. Why do I want to sit in that vestibule like 30 minutes earlier than everybody else?
Well, so they run out of overhead space, and I don't want to check my carry-on. That's why it's a carry-on. Like, at that point, I'm like, I could have brought real luggage with me. So if you're going to check my little bag, it means I could have brought more shoes and hats to wear.
Yeah, I get it.
I mean,
I have the A-list because I do so many short hops for work. And it's like, you get the Southwest first class, which is just an extra legroom seat. And there's like two on the plane. And then after that, it's like, what's the point? Who cares?
I don't know. That's the reason why I don't like Southwest. I think their flight crews are tremendous. I think they're outstanding. By the way, they're no longer a low-cost carrier.
No, that's an issue, is that, like, the ones that used to be deals, there are no more deals.
No. Nowadays to L.A. from here, which used to be like a 60, 70, 80-hour flight, it's like 250 one way.
And while we're complaining about airlines, I'll get this in here as well. I understand I'm fatter than most. However, I would say the sizes of seats on planes have not grown as the average size of humans have grown in the United States over the last 20 years. Yeah. They may in fact actually be getting smaller.
Definitely smaller.
So we got to do something. Like, I would spend more money on my ticket to guarantee a bigger seat. Like, if all seats were bigger,
I would spend more money to not sit next to you.
Yeah, a lot of people do. I one time got on a Southwest flight. I was in like the last group, and a husband and wife were next to each other about my age, and there was no more seats left. They were the only seat left. I sat down next to them, and I heard the husband go, "Oh, man." And I heard the wife whisper, "I'll switch seats with you," meaning that she'd sit next to me. But like, he was fat too.
The best was, I had two quick stories. One time there was a guy, and I give him a ton of credit because he was very heavy set, but he was sitting here like this with his arms.
That's what I do. I get as small as I can be with my legs as far away as possible.
But I told the guy, I said, bro, we got a long flight. I said, relax. I said, it is what it is. Like, I didn't want the guy to be that uncomfortable for that long. It's just not like, it's fine. I'll deal with it. No problem. But one time I'm getting on a Southwest flight, and I get in the middle seat in the first row because that's my thing. I'm like the last person to board, and I just take the shortest seat to get out of the plane. And the guy was so funny. He leans into me. He goes, "Hey, you didn't see that? I said, dude, I missed it. If I had known, this person was like halfway into my seat. I mean, it was bad. It was bad. I mean, I felt like I was going in there for a rebound on every play. Like, I crashing the glass.
Remember, there was a point where they wanted to charge fat people.
Yes.
I would do that, but I don't believe the airline would honor it. If I said, I'm fat, correct, I want the seat next to me, the airline would be like, no, we're going to sell it again.
I agree with you, absolutely.
I don't believe that they would honor me buying that ticket, and I would lose money on it, yeah, and then be uncomfortable.
My strategy is always, especially when I travel with calling games for an arena football team, I make sure I become best friends with the offensive linemen, because what we do, I save them, I get in the window, I save them an aisle seat, and I try to make sure all the offensive linemen, 300-plus, they come in and I'm like, get as big as you can. And they get,
I'm like,
get that growl, like get that, pretend you're about to line up across, across Gilbert Brown.
Get
all right?
a sandwich
Give me,
and start
fierce.
Eating it.
And there have been flights, so there was one empty seat, and it is that seat in between me and the offensive lineman.
Also, I think it should be you shouldn't be allowed to eat food on a plane that smells.
Well, I think there should be no beverage or food service on any flight that's less than 2 hours.
That's fine. I'm talking more like people will bring a sandwich on that has onions in it, and you got Subway onion smell the whole flight.
It does crack me up when you're on a Vegas to Southwest flight or to a San Diego flight. You're in the air for 35 minutes, and someone's like, can I have a triple cappuccino with four creams? And they're like, sure.
To your point, when I see people order, that's a great example that Ben just used on a flight from like San Diego to Vegas. It's so short. Somebody's like, yeah, can I get a double vodka? I'm like, you should be friends with Bill W. The fact that you're ordering a double drink on a 35-minute flight.
I disagree with you. No. Especially if it's a vacation, even if it's a work trip, you got to hit the ground running in the new city.
That's one of the issues of living in Vegas, right? Every flight coming to Vegas is generally loud and somewhat like just kind of
people.
I'm trying to sleep, but I love the flights on the way out. Man, if I just doubled down on that hand, or if I didn't blah, blah, blah. I'm like, good, now you'll be quiet on this flight because you didn't win the $1 million.
Best part of living in Vegas is when you leave for some sort of trip and everybody, it's just, you're like, this is awesome.
Exactly.
This is awesome.
That's exactly right.
Well, can we just do real quick Wimbledon thoughts here for tomorrow while we're down to the semis women's side in our final segment here. Yeah. So Ange Jabeur, Aryna Sabalenka, outstanding matchup. First off, I'm all in the bottom half. Kind of feels like this is the de facto final. $1.55 I'm seeing on Sabalenka. What's your take on the matchup here?
Yeah, this is going to be an interesting one. I'm going to favor Sabalenka just simply because of the power. I think she's got a great opportunity to win this whole thing. Don't know if she closes it out. Jabeur is very consistent. She's got tremendous drop shots, could present some problems for Sabalenka. Remember, she had a set lead against Rybakina in the finals last year and lost. She did get the revenge against Rybakina this year, but I think Sabalenka moves on. And then the other side, Ben, between Svitolina and Bondarusova, I hope Svitolina wins. I've been a fan of hers for a long time, but I think this is a tough one to call. I wouldn't bet it.
No doubt. That's one I would completely stay away from. Vondrosova, about $1.30 favorite against Svitolina. It's their first all-time meeting on grass. I'll say so what's fascinating to me from the market perspective here, Amal. So you had the match with Jabeur. It was the rematch of the Wimbledon final match last year with Rybakina.
Yeah.
Rybakina got steamed in the betting market. She was bet up to about $1.75 favorite. I power rate Aryna Sabalenka higher than I do Elena Rybakina. And it's all just because of perspective. People think, oh, well, she won Wimbledon. Sabalenka wasn't even allowed to play Wimbledon last year since she's from Belarus. So Sabalenka, if this number drops, because there's been early betting interest on Jabeur, like under $1.50, to me is a ridiculous price on Sabalenka. Now, that price on Rybakina was probably way too high to begin with, but I definitely believe you have to give an edge to Sabalenka, who's been so much better on grass. I might be a little biased because that's my one future play, but I just don't see why is there a 30-cent difference between Sabalenka and Rybakina when I view Sabalenka as the better player.
Also, Sabalenka beat Ange Jabeur in 2021 at Wimbledon.
Yeah,
6-4, 6-3. So she's 3-1 head-to-head lifetime against her. So I think a much better play there. Again, like I said, the other match, coin toss.
Yeah, and really, where you pinpoint the turnaround for Sabalenka, it was at the WTA Finals in Fort Worth last year. She beat Jabeur, came back, won in a really tight three-setter. And Sabalenka, I mean, Amal has been a different player since.
No question.
Won the Australian Open in January. Now here she is in the Wimbledon semifinal tomorrow. Men's will be on Friday. So I'm sure Molly will get some men's thoughts tomorrow since the men have the day off tomorrow. But we're down to the final four there. Carlos Alcaraz, Daniil Medvedev, and then Jannik Sinner and Novak Djokovic. All right, Molly, as always, been a blast hanging with you.
Great work with you, Ben. Safe travels to both of you guys.
Thank you.
You're both going to the airport.
We are. Dustin, enjoy that airport beer, man. Happy vacation.
You think there's just going to be one?
I didn't want to presume, you know. So they teach you in journalism school. Don't ever assume. Those are dangerous. For Dustin, for Amal, for our entire outstanding crew here at the South Point in Las Vegas, I'm Ben Wilson saying so long. Hear from VSiN's Sharp Money.